That's saxophone virtuoso James Carter with Clifford Brown's Sandu. Clifford Brown, also a virtuoso on trumpet, died in 1956 at the age of 25, and he wrote many standards that are still cherished today. This, in fact, is from James Carter's Jurassic Classics album, released in 1994. With James on soprano and tenor sax, Craig Taborn on piano, Jaribu Shahid on bass, and Tani Tabal on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, May the 14th. In the second half of our program today, we continue our what I would best call the alternate or alternative discussion on the Donald Sterling NBA debacle. But first, once again, we return to the manufactured crisis with the U.S. Postal Service. And I say manufactured because in the series that we've been doing on the U.S. Postal Service, we have come to appreciate the fact that this is, in fact, a manufactured crisis, the aim of which ultimately is to privatize the Postal Service, to hand over the entire system to corporations that are politically connected. And with that, we have a bipartisan congressional effort, supposedly in the face of the money woes that the post office is confronting, proposing a series of draconian so-called reforms. But we know what that means. It means jobs that will be lost, and again, the privatization effort accelerated. Joining me now from California is David Welsh. He's a retired letter carrier from the Bay Area. He was a full-time vice president of the National Association of Letter Carriers in San Francisco. He currently is a delegate to the San Francisco Labor Council. Thank you, David, for joining us today.
Well, I was very happy to be here, Eutrice.
Well, it wasn't a pleasant thing to read last week's notice, news reports that, released on May 9th, that the Postal Service has experienced yet another quarter of losses, posting a net loss of $1.9 billion, liabilities of $64 billion, exceeding assets of $42 billion, and a 4% dip in the main revenue for the post office, which is its first class mail. It was, according to the report, the 20th time in the last 22 quarters that the U.S. Postal Service posted a loss. And, of course, this is not good news, and it only adds to the so-called legitimate move by this bipartisan congressional committee to rein in these astronomical losses by the U.S. Postal Service. How are you reading the report?
Well, you know, there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. And this is another set of statistics that basically, the way it's framed by the media, tells a lie. Because the Postal Service in the quarter we're talking about, the most recent reported quarter, showed an operating profit. In other words, the operating revenues exceeded the costs of running the post office. It's because of, as you pointed out, the manufactured aspect of this, that it's showing a paper loss, and that is the prefunding of the health benefits of future retirees 75 years into the future.
Could you explain how it is that you say in the last quarter there was, in fact, a profit? But there is a report. It's an official report. It has gotten the sanction of Congress that, yes, this is yet another example and issued no less than from the Postal Service itself. How could you contend that there was a legitimate profit in that period, but there is this loss? How could the two exist at the same time?
Well, it's because of this artificial imposition of this charge, of this debt, to pay for future retirees who haven't even been born yet, that is showing a paper loss. However, the article in the New York Times, which I'm looking at right now, about this same report, points out that there is an operating profit, and it's a rise in revenue in the packaging business, and a drop in revenue in the first-class department. But overall, it's still operating at a profit. And so I think there's a big disinformation campaign going on here, which is being reinforced week in and week out by the mainstream media. But actually, the post office is a going concern. And that's why we want to keep it alive as a public service, because there's a tremendous move, not only in this area, but in other areas of the economy, to privatize the public spaces that remain.
The U.S. Postal Service is the only federal agency, if you will, that has been mandated to set aside 75 years worth of retirees' health benefits, with current payments amounting to about $5.5 billion a year for the next 10 years. How is it possible that this has been allowed to stand? How is it possible that it came about? How is it possible that it continues? And what has to be done to at least appeal to reason that this is just, by any measure, extremely not only unusual, but you can argue quite discriminatory? Why should the Postal Service of all agencies be saddled with this burden?
No, it definitely is. It's not only is there no other federal agency or government agency, but no private company has to shoulder this burden. This was enacted in 2006, and it was supported by the ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is supported by the notorious Koch brothers. And it's one of a number of measures intended to privatize any part of the public sector that is making a profit. And I think it has several aims. It aims to, first of all, make a profit for United Parcel Service and other Pitney Bowes, R. Donnelly and Company, and others that are involved in the mailing industry. And It's also intended to dismantle the public post office and their unions. Now, for instance, in 1970, we had a postal strike. It was a nationwide postal strike that shut down the mail for a week. And it was enormously successful. It was a wildcat strike. And out of it came the United States Postal Service and a tremendous improvement in the wages and conditions of people doing the work. And at the time, in 1970, the Postal Service was basically, the postal work was basically poverty-level work. You couldn't make it in that Vietnam War inflation era. You just couldn't make it on what you earned in the post office. So the people were upset. They were ready to take a risk, and they did. And it resulted in that those first contracts had full cost of living. And so it enabled postal workers to keep up and with the cost of living and to improve their wages and standard of living. So today it's a living wage job. You can't get rich, but you can live off it. So that's a tremendous thing, and also the people who want to destroy the Postal Service also want to destroy the workforce, which is the largest unionized workforce in the United States. It's the second largest workforce in the United States after Walmart. And what they would love to do is to break this up, peel off the profitable parts, give it to their friends in private industry, and reduce postal work to Walmart wages. So it's part of I think you could call it a conspiracy or an agreement that it's not hidden. It's open. These people, you know, proudly say what they're out to do, and they will deprive people of this important service that's been around since 1775, before the country was even founded. And that's when Ben Franklin was named the first Postmaster General. Later it was enshrined in the Constitution that this is a public service that the government needs to provide the people of this nation. It binds the country together, where if you mail a letter in Alaska to South Carolina, it's the same post is 49 cents, regardless of where you mail it. So it's uniform rates, and it means that it's very economical. For instance, package delivery. If you compare Postal Service rates to United Parcel or FedEx, it's much more reasonable priced. And better service, too, because you've got a post office right on the corner. You can go and pick up your package. You don't have to wait to be there until the FedEx or United Parcel can come back and deliver your package. It's much more convenient. You know, there are 32,000 post offices in the country. Now, that's a lot of post offices. One of their objectives is to take the post offices in these rural areas, the post offices in inner city areas, and close them down. And they've closed quite a few, but there's still 32,000 that remain. And this is a center of the communities. And it's a place that people and small businesses gather around. And it's something that they have in their sights.
Let's return for a second to this critical question about this 75-year mandate to fund the health care, the funds of retirees. What is being done to dismantle that? Why can't Congress understand that this is a problem? They created it. They've put this unusual and distinctive burden on the U.S. Postal Service. It is a recipe for fiscal disaster, as it has been over the years. It will continue to challenge the fiscal performance of the U.S. Postal Service. Why? What is happening to dismantle this burden, this mandate on the U.S. Postal Service, singular to the Postal Service?
Well, the unions, of course, have been fighting it legislatively by lobbying. And the problem is that the Congress is elected according to how much money these private companies are willing to lavish on these on their servants in Congress. So it's a very corrupt institution, and even though we do have some allies in the postal in the Congress, and we rely on them to pass a good postal reform bill, but unfortunately, the Congress has not been on our side in recent years. So we need to, I think, get into the streets, because the lobbying approach, while necessary, is not enough.
Well, I've got to tell you, on that score, it seems to be that the union itself is not nearly as brisk as it ought to be in getting into the streets. I mean, I've seen the situation where locals are taking initiatives, but as a national union, I'm not aware that it has been as aggressive as it ought to be to get this issue heard by the public and to basically encourage public participation.
Well, I think that's changing, because I know that Donahoe, the Postmaster General, came into office in 2010, I believe, and the following year there were demonstrations in all 435 congressional districts by all four postal unions, and that was a very powerful statement. After that, there was kind of a lull in street activity by the unions, but now with the election of a new national president by the American Postal Workers Union, which is one of the main unions, we're seeing an uptick in activity. For instance, one of the things the post office is doing is they're trying to privatize the retail part of the business. The when you go up to the window in the post office and buy your stamps or bring your packages, they're trying to privatize that with an agreement with the Staples store. Now, Staples is the number one office supply chain in the country, and the Postal Service has an agreement with them for 82 Staples stores are going to have a postal kiosk inside their store and doing all kinds of postal business, but it's going to be performed not by a uniformed postal employee making a living wage, but by a low-wage worker with no job security. So the kind of worker which you find in Staples stores. And so this is a tremendous threat to the Postal Service and to the workers there.
They should have considered that plan, considering that Staples is closing up quite a few of its stores nationwide.
Well, that's another thing. What kind of security of the mail would there be if the Staples decides according to its own corporate considerations to close the store? Then, meanwhile, you put in a Staples store, the post office nearby closes, then the Staples decides to close, then there's no service. In fact, there's a real threat in the rural areas where the post office is present that there'll be no service at all if the post office gets eliminated. One of the things we're working on, the unions have united to come to come together on, is the idea of postal banking. There used to be a postal bank until 1967 or so. It was started in the early years of the early 1900s when people, there were a lot of immigrants coming here, mainly from Europe at that time, and they had experienced the loss of their life savings when banks failed. And even there was a panic in the United States in I think it was 1907. There was a panic, and the banks failed, and people lost their savings. And so they created this postal bank where people, including these immigrants, could could put their money and have some assurance that their money was going to be there when they want to take it out. Well, now, today, when we're facing this tremendous scams by these banks who have ripped off the people, foreclosed on their homes, caused the financial crisis of 2008 with their financial shenanigans, and these banks are not to be trusted, these monopoly banks. And we need to bring back postal banking. We need to put a bank in every post office. You know, the banks are closing in the rural areas. The banks are closing in inner city areas. They're closing their branches, making it very inconvenient for the people to bank. The solution is to take these 32,000 post offices and put a bank back in there, as was in existence here from 1912 to 1967. And many other countries' post offices around the world have banks. And also, it's you have a lot of people who have no work or low work or low-wage work who go to these payday loan companies, and they get ripped off in order to get an advance on their pay. They pay enormous rates of interest. And if the bank could, the postal bank could do the same thing and more conveniently without ripping off these people who are already having a hard time making it in this low-wage economy where jobs are being outsourced and jobs are being eliminated at a fantastic rate.
What is the next, what is the next major date, if we will, or next major move that Congress is likely to make? It has been meeting. It has come up with some proposals about basically raising revenue by auctioning off real estate. We had Peter Byrne, the investigative reporter, here with us talking about the fact that there's a reason to believe that there should be a major criminal investigation into this this aspect of the reform plan to sell off the post offices that are deemed supposedly unnecessary and other postal post office buildings or related buildings. We found that it's an $85 billion real estate program put in the hands of the husband of Dianne Feinstein, the senator from California, and they are the only people who have this contract. It's a no-bid contract to sell off $85 billion of real estate. According to Peter Byrne, his year-long investigation showed that the properties were being sold at or below market values, as opposed to above market value, that they were basically sold to companies affiliated with the real estate company. There seems to have been no investigation into this at all. And yet, this bipartisan committee is proposing to raise millions, if not billions, of dollars in selling off these post office properties in a situation that raises huge conflict of interest questions. What is the challenge to this? Are you aware of anything that the union is doing with respect to calling for this investigation, that it should be open and transparent, and that there should be a criminal investigation into this if, in fact, this is true?
Yeah, I think, for instance, I believe Goldman Sachs owns 10% of this real estate company, CBRE, and they got a sweetheart deal on buying up a property from the post office in Boston. And there are lots of examples of these in the recent years of this kind of double dealing and corruption in the last few years. Now, here in Berkeley, California, we've had a struggle of almost 2 years to stop the sale of the Berkeley post office, which is a historic, almost 100-year-old post office. And it's a landmarked building. It's a beautiful building. And the community has rallied has rallied to stop it. And we've had the city council was 100% behind stopping the sale. The two houses of the state legislature and the congresswoman from this area are all united in wanting to stop the sale. In addition, we had for 33 days, we had a tent city on the steps of the Berkeley Post Office. We had several dozen people for over a month camping out on the steps of the post office and on the property of the post office to call attention to this. We got wall-to-wall media about this so that practically everybody in Berkeley by now knows about this and is angry. And right now are collecting signatures as the last day of a petition to go on the ballot in November, which would prevent them from selling the post office if the public service aspect of the post office was not included. In other words, it would basically rule out the sale of the post office for a private gain.
But here we have a situation where this sweetheart deal would generate $1 billion in commissions to the husband of the U.S. senator. this does not occur to this bipartisan committee as something that it ought to investigate.
Right. You know, we had we went to, you know, Darrell Issa is a congressman from Southern California who's kind of taking the lead. He's the chairman of the committee in the House of Representatives that is proposing this bill, which would basically privatize the post office. There was a time in at the lame duck session, I believe it was 2013, forget the year, I believe it was last year.
Mm-hmm.
There was the lame duck session of Congress. Darrell Issa and Senator Joe Lieberman, representing the two houses of Congress, said that they announced that they were going to use the lame duck Congress to reduce delivery, postal delivery, from 6 days to 5 days. So a number of us went to Washington, D.C., and we set up a tent right facing the Capitol building with signs on it, and we had a hunger strike there, and we said we are opposed to reducing the delivery from 6 days to 5 days. And we went in and occupied Darrell Issa's office, and we stayed there. We said we're not leaving until Darrell Issa comes to talk to us about this. And they said, oh, he's on the floor. He's on the hill, in an important bill. And anyway, so we stayed there. We sang songs, you know the Beatles song, 8 days a week. Well, we changed it to 6 days a week. And finally he came out, and he debated us for 20 minutes, in which he defended his plan to privatize the post office. Anyway, it was very interesting. One of our members was arrested, and so that was a good thing that we have served notice on him and on the Congress that this wasn't going to happen, and it didn't happen at that time. Now they're coming back and they're trying to do it again.
What can the public do? I mean, this is a serious and formidable challenge to the notion of how the post office traditionally has run. This is a marked departure from any what would be considered normal political process. You have more than enough questions that should trouble the mind of any legislator about these conflicts of interest, these unusual sweetheart deals, the billions of dollars that are involved, and I can't call it anything else but a conspiratorial plan, it seems, to literally dispose of the post office the thousands and thousands of jobs that go with it, but also the service that goes with it. And we're sensing that they seem to have the upper hand here. They seem to have the cards, the Trump cards in this fight. How can the public get behind the unions, and what could they do to make their voices heard about all of these issues with the U.S. Postal Service?
Oh, well, I think one of the things is that the Senator Bernie Sanders has a bill in Congress, and also Representative DeFazio from Oregon has a bill that will end the prefunding mandate, that ridiculous 75-year prefunding mandate that we were talking about earlier, would end that and would put the Postal Service on a good financial footing. That's very important that the Sanders-DeFazio bill be supported. The second thing is there's a campaign of the American Postal Workers Union that's supported by all the postal unions to stop the use of staple stores to have postal work performed by non-union people. So this is another very important thing, is that people don't have to shop at Staples. People can shop somewhere else, go to some other place. Don't go to Staples. So that's one very important thing that people can get behind. And there are regular demonstrations at Staples in many places where this is happening, so they can look around to join those demonstrations and also not to go there themselves, and to get their community organizations or whatever organizations they're part of not to buy their office supplies from Staples. So that's a current campaign that's very strong. They should also insist that there be no ending of Saturday delivery. You know, there's even a move afoot in the ISA bill to end door-to-door delivery. In other words, people would have to pick up their mail up some distance from their house in cluster boxes, which are notorious for being vandalized. And the security of the mail is severely compromised when people have been getting home delivery of the mail, you know, for centuries in this country. And they're used to it. They want it. The Postal Service is the most loved government agency. Now, it should be kept as a public service. We need to keep home delivery. We need to keep these post offices. We need to put new uses in the post office. We need to have postal banks in the post offices. We need to have longer hours, not shorter hours. We need to eliminate the lines in the post office by having more postal clerks. That's another thing. They've deliberately understaffed these post offices so the people will complain about it, to have to further their unprincipled campaign to privatize the post office.
So, well, David, we will come back to you to update the struggle, because it is ongoing, but it has reached a kind of fever pitch with this report coming out last Friday. I want to thank you so much for joining us today and to bring us up to speed. We will check in again, because this is a story very, very important, I think, to the public, and so we'll be following it. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Thanks. When we come back, we'll talk about the famous, the NBA scandal. We'll talk about that from your perspective right after this tiny, tiny break. Well, you didn't have time to talk about it yesterday, so you might as well get in on it today, 888-874-4888. Lots of reaction to the presentation, and most of it, I will say, is kind of thank you for approaching this discussion in a very different way. That was the uniform reaction that I got from listeners saying, I mean, this was a very different way to consider the problem and the story that is being presented to the country as, well, you know, the salacious part of the story and all of that for all those reasons that people are paying attention to it. But that the alternative narrative is a huge and far more important story. That is the story that we need to get involved in, and that is, what is this nature of racism that everybody in the story is caught up in that web of racism as defined not by just somebody, you know, making ugly remarks. That's kind of simplistic, because that happens every day. It doesn't matter whether it's a billionaire or just your regular, you know, run-of-the-mill idiot. But the story behind the story, that's really what we want to talk about, you know, just getting your reaction today. DX from L.A., what have you to say? I heard from you yesterday.
Yes, you did. And I beat Sarah to the punch this time. I know she's waiting. yeah, thank you, Eutrice, for just, I mean, I have gotten so fed up with this. It's just, it's ridiculous. Thank you for being my bastion of sanity in the middle of this media crazy house. Thank you for talking about this shoddy media we have in this country. And you can replace the ODD with the ITT if you want. So I had a couple of observations. I was, I'm just looking at, okay, you are absolutely right that the players do not know what this is all about. They've totally missed the boat. And not only that, most of the people consuming this nonsense have lost the real points of what's going on here. You elaborated on some of those yesterday. But just to show how the players just don't get it, I was watching yesterday, in fact, I was watching NBA online. I don't pay for any of this stuff, by the way. I always get all this stuff online. There's ways. So I'm watching TNT, and the hosts of this show, TNT Overtime, are Ernie Johnson, Charles Barkley, former player, Kenny Smith, former player, and Shaq O'Neal, former player. And they go through talking, because the Clippers were playing. So they go through talking about the whole scandal with Donald Sterling and if it's distracting the players and this and that. And the only white guy on the panel, Ernie Johnson, asked the other three black guys, "Do you forgive Donald Sterling?" This was the monumental question after going through everything that's happened. The only thing he could think to ask was, "Do you forgive Donald Sterling?" The three of them, Charles Barkley, Shaq O'Neal, and Kenny Smith, came back with various answers, but nobody really delved into what's really going on here, of course, because this is an NBA-sponsored show. So they had answers ranging from yes, I would forgive him, to no, I'll never forgive him. And I'm like, this is like really a juvenile way to approach this. It's that it's just no thought put into it. Just this is the only thing we can think of. So, and another thought I had on this, it's not just the mainstream media on this. I'm watching online a website called, a blog called TYT, the Young Turks. I don't know if you've heard of it before, but
mm-hmm. Yes.
Cenk Uygur is the main guy over there.
Right.
So I'm watching this, and this is supposed to be progressive media. This is not mainstream. This is supposed to be. And as you know, Cenk Uygur, you probably know, he went and worked for, I believe it was MSNBC, and came back. So he went to the mainstream media, didn't like it. I guess they were trying to keep him from doing certain things and talking about certain things. So he came back. So on this TYT network, they were talking about this story. And unfortunately, they were approaching it from the exact same angle, how mm-hmm. horrible what he said was and all this other stuff. And then, for good measure, they throw in Jay-Z getting slapped in the face and beat up by Beyonce's sister in an elevator.
Right.
Now, I bring up this to say that if the so-called progressive media is going to do this kind of crap and sound just like the mainstream media, most of the progressive media, what real chance do we have to get our hands on some real information and real knowledge, real news? And I think it's just shameful that all these people are just jumping on this from this particular angle because it's salacious, because they get ratings, because they get more eyes on their website. And I think that's just ridiculous. What do you think about that?
Well, I was going to ask you a question. I highlighted the caliber of conversation that is occurring within the Jewish media.
Uh-huh.
The questions that they're asking, how could this person be synonymous with bigotry? You know, what kind of guy is this who claims to have some degree of connection to us? We don't know him as a Jew, as a philanthropic Jew. We don't
Absolutely
know him
not.
As a person supporting Jewish causes at a level that he ought to be. We don't know either him or his wife as being deeply involved in Jewish philanthropy. They're asking questions about how is it that we have so many Jews as owners in this particular
right.
sport. How did that happen? They're discussing questions like whiteness. Am I white or am I a Jew? These are discussions going on. These are deep questions that this community is dealing with in the open.
Right.
And you see the caliber of at which they are engaging and interpreting this event, which is very deep.
But you even get it from the progressive media, is what I'm saying. It's like, why? If you're supposed to be a progressive media outlet, why aren't they talking about these things instead of the same old salacious stuff that gets people all riled up? I mean, they're doing the same thing, which is what I don't get. And,
right.
you know, the conversation you were having yesterday was where we need to be. And we need to discuss, okay, what kind of a culture makes these people feel compelled or whatever, however you want to say it, to change the names to white-sounding names. And not only just Mr. and Mrs. Sterling, but also this V. Steviano.
That's the whole point. Everybody, whether it's Steviano as an alleged African-Mexican, or we have Sterling as a Jew who has anglicized his name, or we have
right.
the black ball players, everybody is polarized against this construct of whiteness in America. They all are caught up in this whole thing in one way or the other of defining themselves and consequently their relationships to each other based on this empirical notion of whiteness. And that's the discussion that is going on in the Jewish community.
They want to be part of the white privilege. You spoke of it last week. When I called, you talked about your friend who just cannot face the fact that she couldn't afford food. She stole
right.
food. She had this sense of white privilege. I think this is the kind of feeling that they're going for. I want to be part of the accepted. I want to have the privileges of being, you know, white. And this V. Steviano, I don't know if she did it because of Sterling, but in 2010 she changed her name from She's
changed her name for many reasons, mostly including for legal reasons.
Maria Vanessa Perez or something like that. So
she was busted on a couple of charges, so it was convenient for her to change her name a couple of times.
Right.
But she also said consciously.
Why to an Italian-sounding name, though?
Because she's exotic. She has exoticized herself. This is really, really, really deep. We're going to have to talk about this just by itself alone. Thanks, DX, for calling. And guess who is up next?
Sarah.
Oh, gee, you're really a psychic. Thanks a lot. Sarah from Dallas, you're on the air.
Greetings to you, Utrice, and greetings to DX. DX, I was leaving that spot open for you. I had not heard you in a while, so I decided I was not going to be monopolizing Utrice's airtime, so they would think that I'm a paid caller. But
so what are your thoughts? What's happening with the information you're receiving so far? And the discussion yesterday and the stark contrast between how this discussion is resonating in the Jewish community, within the Jewish media, about questions. I mean, we're all observing the same incident mm-hmm. and the same issue and the same story, but this is the level at which they are engaging. They're not even talking about the salacious part of this thing.
Well, that's exactly how it normally works, Utrice, and to what DX was stating with this excuse that they're always asking us about if we forgive. You know, like when something is done, the onus is always put back on the victim to say, okay, that we need to forgive. We need to extend an olive branch. And this is the thing that really and truly gets on my nerve when we always come out here and we always ask for an apology. And we always talking about forgiving them and praying for people and all this other foolishness that always gets floats around here. This is why we do not get respected as the people you treat. We get treated as a joke.
I'll tell you one thing. I'm going to go again with the Jewish concept. There is no way to forgive. If the concept is when you have committed a wrong,
mm-hmm.
you are obligated to return to the wrong, right? To return
mm-hmm.
to it, face up to it, embrace responsibility 100% for it, and forgiveness is not what you ask.
No, it's not.
You don't ask for forgiveness. You basically are compelled to atone. So it's atonement that is the issue.
Exactly, Utrice, which is why when I could not even watch the full clip with Sterling, because when he's going to make it, you know, he didn't even apologize. He was just trying to bring Magic Johnson into this and saying, okay, well, then again, you know, he's not even a good role model for the community. He has AIDS and he has this. You know, it's like it was just nauseating, and I'm glad to see that Anderson Cooper, at least he showed some kind of emotion on his face and saying that, you know, I can't really, really believe this guy and his attorney would allow him to come on TV and not rehearse him and for him to make himself look like a fool.
Well, it may seem like he was making himself look like a fool, but he was actually shoring up his defense. He's a lawyer. And he knows that if he appears, it's like Oscar Pistorius. If you play the act really well, you at least will get sympathy, and people would start thinking, well, maybe, as his wife has suggested,
you suffer from dementia.
Maybe you're losing it. You know,
that's not even the point, Utrice, because we always know that in situations like this, they're the only ones who get to claim the insanity defense, as you said with Oscar Pistorius, and now with him going to come out here and say, okay, well, maybe I was, you know, not on the right medication, and maybe I'm starting to suffer from Alzheimer's, but which is not any excuse, because he's not going to suffer from Alzheimer's if you write him a check and the check is missing a few zeros on it. He's going to know right away that, hey, you write me the wrong amount of on this check, or you give me back the wrong change.
We're not on that level of – we're not even discussing the story. We are – let's just say we have observed the reports that the media have been providing – and we understand it to be super simplistic and consistent with what the media thinks the public wants. But we're now operating at a whole different level, and we're not even dealing with how it's being covered in the media anymore. We understand what the deal is there. But we're looking at this issue of how the irony that all parties involved essentially are being measured and are measuring themselves against this notion of whiteness in America.
Exactly, Utrice. And as SDX says, this is all because everyone knows that there is some benefit in order to fit into this club that's classified as being a white. You get some benefits, you get some sort of protection. Because when Barbara Walters, she came out here with her nonsense and asked his wife, well, is he a racist? And she has a way of making her face and doing all of these facial animations that really and truly gets on my nerves. And I'm glad that this is her last week. Because if though she was giving her an end out to come up and say, well, oh, well, he's not, you married this man for 60 years. Exactly. Are you going to go on TV and say that your husband is a racist, even though you know that he is?
No, but the question right there, immediately, what people needed to have understood about that was Barbara Walters herself expunged the wife from any racial animus whatsoever. She basically said, is your husband a racist? She never asked, are you also a racist? She never asked
exactly.
a question.
Exactly, because how it is, you're married to this man for 60 years, then she can pull out some phony divorce papers that she just put together. I've already have it here, I have it signed. Like, why would I divorce this man, Utrice? If I'm married to him for 60 years, he's 80 plus years old. He might die within the next 4 or 5 years or even less from the stress of this thing. What sense would it make for me to divorce him now? It doesn't make any sense.
Yes, but what is the irony in that meeting of Barbara Walters with Rochelle Sterling? What was the great irony?
To me, what I see in there is, as you said, is that, you know, when she asked her about her involvement with the slum lord and all this other stuff, and, you know, and she lied, because there has been depositions that have shown that she was one of those that came up there as a phony housing inspector.
Right.
And she, in essence, she lied when she sat up there and she said, no, it was never any sort of thing like that.
Think bigger than that. Think much bigger than that.
Well, she was saying that as far as the team goes within the selling of the team, she says, though, that she's not, and her attorney backed her up and saying that, no, she's not going to be, she cannot be held responsible for what her husband said, and she's not going to be selling the team, which we already know that these people, they have no intention. This is all theatrics.
All right. What is Barbara's last name?
Walters.
Okay. What was her original family's name?
It is something from Eastern Europe. You know, they're all...
Well, exactly. The point is that she is speaking to her sister in more ways than one.
Yep, because they all changed their identity.
That's exactly the point. Here's a woman who herself is a byproduct of this morphing into this middle ground. Am I Jewish? When am I Jewish and when am I white?
Mm-hmm.
And we will discard for the moment her admission in her book, Auditions, about the fact that she was involved in an affair with the black senator.
Ed Brooke.
Ed Brooke from Massachusetts. Leaving that aside, we're talking about identity here. Her identity is very much identical to the woman she's talking to.
Yep.
And therefore, psychologically, she identifies and she says she gives this woman immediate exemption. There is no way you could be a racist, but he is, isn't he? Do you consider him a racist? She's talking about the woman's husband. But the point I'm making is that's the irony right there. She is the epitome of what this group, this generation that came after the mass immigration from Europe, from Poland and from Eastern Europe, the Ashkenazi influx into the United States, what these people did as a way to move up.
Yeah,
as a way to assimilate. Barbara Walters is the epitome, the exemplar of how many Jews in the United States morphed into the American ideal.
Yeah.
So she is both Jewish when she wants to be, and she is middle white American when she wants to be.
Yeah, you're right about that, Utrice, because it's that fence straddling where when it's advantageous for us to use a Jewish identity as the affirmative action, so to speak, then okay, I can step on that and I can say I'm a Jew. But in the meantime, you know, I want to be accepted into white America. I don't want you to hold anything else against me. So, as you said, Yatrice, I'm looking forward to the rest of your program. I'll let you go and finish off
thank
the rest of the
thank
show.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Sarah, for your call today. I want to thank you all for listening. And, of course, tomorrow, another good program I hope you will join us for. I've been really intrigued by your responses. And we will get to that, of course, this Friday as well with our Free Your Mind Friday. Stay tuned. Keep it right here. Alternative Visions with Jack Rasmus is next. And we'll see each other tomorrow at the same time. Do tell a friend, and let's grow this program. Bye-bye.